We all know there are tons of personalities in fashion. I mean, geez, scroll through the podcast feed. But someone I've always admired is GQ's Rachel Tashjian. Whether it's her hot takes on Twitter, her incredibly diverse wardrobe, or astute fashion criticisms, she's one of the most refreshing and humorous people I know. Naturally, she's back on the pod. We chat about how to view the world of fashion differently, why she shops secondhand, and why fashion criticism is more important than ever. It's Blammo Extra, and Rachel Tashjian is back. Some of the stuff I've been reading of you has been some very astute observations of the previous landscape of fashion writing, like things like that.
I don't know. I mean, I guess I would say it seems to me that we've entered in a very specific mode of assessing fashion and style. And I guess I'm sort of interested in pointing out that we're looking at fashion in this totally singular way and exploring other ways of looking at it and assessing its quality. Does that make sense?
No, yeah. Like what are some of these ways that are appearing to be archaic now?
Well, I think there is, it's very, it became during the Trump administration. Well, but this totally predates Trump, I guess I should say.
Yeah, I agree.
I think Robin Givhan is the person who started doing all this.
Of the Washington
and she's an
Post.
Absolute, yes. And she's an absolute genius. I mean, she wrote this incredible piece. I guess this was in 2004 when Dick Cheney wore a parka to the inauguration. And she wrote this genius dissection of why this was absolutely inappropriate. And I don't know if you remember this kind of miserable, you know, I mean, Dick Cheney always kind of looks miserable, but he's wearing this parka and he's like on the stage and you're like, you're in the presidential administration. How is this possible? And I think that kind of reading of fashion, that like kind of semiotic approach to fashion is so important. And it's essential to understanding the way that power works and is communicated and wielded. But I do think that once we entered the Obama years and there was this incredible effort by Michelle Obama to really engage with the fashion industry and realizing that she could potentially like make the careers of these young designers. And really understanding the importance of that role and as that something potentially that like a first lady could do. I think there was a lot of excitement in the fashion world that maybe this was lending a kind of seriousness to what we were doing. I mean, all of a sudden it was like, it's not just like, oh, Jason Wu is this exciting young designer. It's like, well, Jason Wu designed this dress that was worn by Michelle Obama at this very significant moment. Mm-hmm. And so I think very fairly, the fashion industry and the fashion media became really interested in supporting these kinds of narratives. And especially as like a lot of, you know, people only wear so many outfits a day. And it was a way to get access to designers and to get access to some pretty important people in seats of power.
Right.
And I think that when Trump was elected, there was a crisis in the fashion industry and in fashion media.
Just the fashion industry?
we no longer had this partner in the White House who was lending importance to what we were doing. And the narrative was no longer in the control of the designers. So now you have, instead of, you know, okay, there is one of the most powerful and high profile women in the country is working with this designer to craft this specific vision and to craft this message. And we're going to help interpret that message. Now you have like Melania Trump wearing a Gucci pussy bow blouse. And we're like, what the heck does that mean? But we were still, I think, attuned to this very semiotic, like message driven way of looking at fashion. And so we began to construct these like huge hairball narratives about, you know, oh, like so-and-so is giving us this message. So-and-so is like handing down this message by wearing this color and da 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 da. And people continued to do that, of course. It's like the white suit is worn by Hillary Clinton, you know, as she's conceding the race. But then it's like at this, like the same night, we have Melania Trump is wearing a white suit. And people tend to ignore
for the
like
suffrage
Melania
movement.
Yeah, Melania, yeah. People, we ignore Melania Trump wearing the suit because it's like, oh, well, that conflicts with the kind of comfortable narrative structure that we are used to. But this is something I've been thinking about a lot. So I guess what I'm really sort of pushing back against recently is this very constructed, semiotic conspiracy of like, okay, this person wants to convey this message, and the media, the fashion media's job is to push forward that message. Like, for example, I would say that Kamala Harris's suit the night that she the night of
also
the kind
suit.
Of victory party, I thought that suit didn't fit very well.
Why is that?
But instead, I just thought like it, the cream of the blouse didn't quite match the jacket. I thought the jacket was a little too short, but instead what, you know, what we write about is like, it's very empowering that she wore this white suit. And I would agree that that is an interesting message for her to put forth. I thought, you know, she made the right choice in wearing that color and wearing a pantsuit, but there's more to look at there than just this narrative that she's trying to push. And it's your job as a journalist to dig deeper than just like the message that the person is putting out.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a really good point. I think one of the things that like I'm always trying to wonder now is like, when did it become more of the norm to go to have like a full 360 understanding of a designer and their supply chain and their manufacturing in order to endorse them? Because I feel like back in the day, now look, a lot of this stuff was couture, so it was pretty easy to see what their supply chain and labor force was like. But I feel like now, you know, because even like a perfect example, right? Like, so Michelle Obama, she wore a bunch of J. Crew, Jenna Lyons stuff. And now this, they're like, she shouldn't have been wearing that because she should have known of the labor practices that were happening. And even though it was good for her and Jenna Lyons' career and J. Crew and J. Crew Women's and making her wearing clothes that were affordable that people could go buy, she shouldn't have been doing that. And I'm like, well, like no one can win anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's I'm just wondering like when did that all happen of the deeper analyzing of labor forces and all of that other stuff within who people are wearing?
Well, I think a lot of it, you know, started when there were, and I'm trying to think of when this would have been. I mean, like around 2012, I think, is when the Rana Plaza fire happened, which was a fast fashion factory in Bangladesh, where almost everyone, I think it was, I can't quite remember the specifics, but like almost everyone who worked in the factory died. And there were a number of, you know, I can't remember the brand names. It wasn't J. Crew or anything like that, but, and it, I don't think H&M was there, but I'm not giving a very good retelling of this. But I think that sort of, when you started to see these major human rights abuses, like there was more reporting happening, maybe starting around the time that this fire happened, which a lot of it is done by Vanessa Friedman at the Times and Elizabeth Payton and Dana Thomas, who writes for the Times occasionally as well, and wrote a big book actually that came out about a year ago about, it was called Fashionopolis, and it was about fast fashion. So I think that this is actually, I mean, it's something that more fashion writers have been focusing on and journalists have been focusing on for the past 5 or 6 years. And I think it seems like maybe when the pandemic started, actually, people had a moment to sort of think about these things in a way that they didn't before.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's definitely, I don't know, and maybe it's like because there's the, is it the whole sort of buy you know, less but buy better, like let's really analyze the quality of things, or because there's not as much stuff coming out. Because I think also, you know, right, with the pandemic, and this is also a really brilliant piece he wrote about some of the downfall of some of these folks, like Man Repeller, which is kind of heartbreaking. I don't know anyone or anyone on that team personally, but that was like pretty gnarly that like she's almost canceled now.
Yeah. Well, no one gets canceled.
What?
No one actually gets canceled. I mean, it's
what do you
not,
mean?
Like, I don't know. I can't really think of anyone except for Harvey Weinstein who has been actually fully canceled.
Gosha's canceled.
But I was just in Dover Street a couple weeks ago and his stuff is still there.
Really?
Yeah.
Even after all the WhatsApp stuff?
Yeah. Well,
all right. I guess it was still there because no one's buying it?
I don't know. I mean, it looks pretty new to me. But
wild. So wait, you've been shopping? No? You've been going to places?
Yeah, I've been going to places. Yeah. Have you?
I mean, I left. I left New York in September.
Yeah.
No, so what stores and stuff have you been going to? You've been going to Dover? Like, what's it like out there? Want to hear the rest? The hot takes never stop over on the Patreon. Head over to patreon.com/blammo to hear this and many, many more episodes from the return of Sid Mashburn, The Sartorialist, and more. You'll also get access to our private Slack group where we chat about this stuff nonstop with tons of other listeners. So check out patreon.com/blammo and we'll see you there.